Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Good to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Charles. And what did you make of the election results in Germany, where it does appear that there will be what they're calling the Jamaican coalition of Merkel's CDU forming a coalition with the pro-business Free Democratic Party and the Greens? But the key vote, of course, or the one that everybody was looking at, the people who came in third, the alternative for Deutschland, the far-right party, they've gained about 13.3%. So let's begin with that. Is that alarming, or how does it strike you?
Well, you know, I think there are two diametrically opposed ways to interpret the election. One is that it was an earthquake of sorts because for the first time since World War II, you have a far-right, anti-immigrant, nationalist party in the Bundestag, and the CDU and the SPD, the two main center-right and center-left parties, did very poorly, as badly as they've done since World War II. And so you could say, you know, whoa, what's going on here? Things are moving in a worrying direction. On the other hand, you could also say that the center has held, and that's because even though AfD got 13.2%, they're not going to be in the government. The next government, as you put it, is likely to be a Jamaica coalition with the Free Democrats and the Greens. It's still possible, I think, even though the Social Democrats said no thank you, that you could see a grand coalition. So the bottom line is that center-left and center-right have shrunk in terms of their share of the vote, but they still are in control. And so I don't think we'll see any major changes in German foreign policy, in part because Merkel has already moved to the right on immigration to steal the march from AfD. So yes, they're a new force in German politics. Should we all head to the basement because extremist nationalists are coming back to power in Germany? No.
So when the SPD leader, Martin Schulz, says that this election has been a difficult and bitter day for German social democracy, what's going on in terms of these traditional parties in Europe, particularly the socialists? They seem to be falling apart. They certainly fell apart dramatically in France with the center-right coming out of nowhere under Macron and wiping out the socialists. And it's not entirely a wipeout. They're about 20% of the vote, but they're clearly not doing well. Yeah, what explains that phenomenon? Is that in terms of the broader context of Europe itself?
Well, you know, the center-left in Europe has traditionally come from what we Americans would consider the far-left. Socialist, very ambitious and broad welfare state, very strong unions, very ambitious labor law. And over the course of the last couple of decades, the center-left has been divided, if you will, between those who have moved to the center. Tony Blair, in some ways, was the guy who took the British Labor Party, Britain's Social Democrats, to the center. The same thing happened in Germany under Gerhard Schroeder, meaning that there wasn't much difference between Social Democrats and Christian Democrats. But now, because of immigration and because of deindustrialization, socialists are having buyer's remorse. And some of them are tacking back to the far left. Some of them are staying in the center. But they are right now a very divided party. Probably the best example of that is what's happened in the United Kingdom, where the head of the Labour Party, Mr. Corbyn, comes from a very serious socialist background. He has moved labor very far to the left and in some ways into the wilderness. So generally what's happening is that center-right parties are doing reasonably well, enough to be in power in most European countries. Center-left is deeply divided, but The good news is that together, center-left and center-right are holding the governments. And that's why, with the exception of the UK, which is heading toward Brexit, Poland, Hungary, where you have populist parties in power, the situation is generally positive. And I think that, and you were talking with Danielle a little bit about this, Europeans have looked at Brexit, they've looked at Donald Trump, and they've said, no, thank you. And that has, to some extent, re-legitimated the political center.
So when I mentioned in the opening, Charles, that Angela Merkel is becoming more and more referred to on the world stage as the leader of the free world, a title normally assigned to the President of the United States, but it does seem that Donald Trump's disdain for America's longstanding alliances and his growing unpopularity at home and abroad has resulted in the U.S. to some extent relinquishing the role it's had since World War II. Do you think this is terminal, or could this be reversed if Donald Trump let's assume that he doesn't run a second time, or if he does, he gets defeated?
You know, I'm hoping it's terminal. Having lived through the re-election of George W. Bush and the election of Donald Trump, I'm sort of skittish about being optimistic on American politics. But on the other hand, it seems to me that even though Donald Trump has maintained his base, he's losing moderate Republicans, he's losing the political center, and I'm guessing he will continue to govern in an erratic and an extremist way, which will make it difficult for him to be reelected. And so the question I ask myself is, how much damage will be done between now and the next election, when I hope the United States comes back to the reasonable center on many issues? And can Merkel, working with Macron, the French president, and others, hold down the fort while the United States is missing in action? And, you know, we don't know the answer to that. Part of it depends on the decisions that Trump makes on North Korea and on Iran and a whole bunch of other issues. But you do have a situation now in which the two countries most responsible for building the Western world, and they are the United Kingdom and the United States, beginning around 1815, are backing away from that world. The UK because of Brexit, and the United States because of a Donald Trump who has decided, or who believes that he represents, a sector of the American electorate for whom the world erected under Pax Americana is not a good deal. And so he's coming out with a big wrecking ball, and Merkel and her fellow travelers are going to have to try to prevent the damage from being grievous.
But have you figured out, and I certainly haven't, what is the strategic logic of people like Trump? Well, let's assume that people like Bannon might well be more important in the sense that they have shaped his policies, if that's how you can describe them. Bannon, of course, being the chief strategist up until recently. Incidentally, he played an important role in Brexit along with Robert Mercer, his political patron, mm-hmm. who's also the biggest donor to Trump's campaign. And they also played an important role in the last election through Cambridge Analytica, a company whose activities are still being looked at, particularly in the context of these controversies over Facebook. I, for the life of me, cannot understand what their policies are, what their vision is. For example, in Bannon's case, he was recently meeting with the right-hand man of President Xi. He's still out there, you know, being treated as an important person because of his ties to Trump. Apparently, they talk on the phone a lot. And here he is talking about how the Chinese, we've got to stand up to them, they cheat, etc. They don't play fair, and we're at the cusp between whether the United States will be the global leader or China will take over. Well, what was the first thing these guys did was get rid of the TPP, which was an arrangement that Obama had made not so much to contain China, but to organize the neighborhood, you know, in terms of free trade, so that China would have to play by the rules. It right. doesn't make any sense. So have you been able to figure out what these guys stand for? Or are they just bomb throwers and anarchists and you know, wanting to destroy the administrative state or whatever it is that Bannon promised?
You know, I think that many of us thought that it was Bannon that was the problem, and then he left, and now it's Steve Miller, who's the president's senior advisor and speechwriter, who's the problem. But I think, you know, we have to face up to the reality that it's Trump that's the problem, and that the speech that he gave at the United Nations at the beginning of the week was indicative of a president who believes that we live in a world in which hard, self-regarding nation states should go about looking out for their own interests at the expense of everyone else. In other words, he kind of sees the world in zero-sum terms, a little bit like he's out there in New York City building apartment buildings. And if one company's up, another company is down. And the problem is that if every country in the world went out there and essentially mimicked America first, so it was America first, China first, France first, Germany first, where would we be? We'd be back in the Middle Ages, where countries simply didn't give a damn about anyone else. And what happened? Well, we had constant wars, constant bloodshed. And the magic of the post-1945 world is that the United States didn't put itself first in the sense of seeking short-term advantage. It invested in the long term, right? The American taxpayers spent a lot of money on the Marshall Plan, rebuilding Japan, rebuilding Germany. Why? Because they knew that if Germany and Japan in the long run emerged as stable democracies, it would work to our advantage. We now have a president who doesn't understand that. He wants to pull down TPP. He may pull down NAFTA, because he says, okay, is this good for us in the next 24 to 36 hours, as opposed to what's the long-term implication of the United States leading the world and trying to build allies that in the end of the day will band together in the service of prosperity and peace? So I think he just, I don't think he gets it, quite honestly.
Well, I'm not sure, though, about, you know, others in terms of the Republican states, particularly in terms of, for example, we were talking with Daniela about, you know, the importance of trade, Germany being the world's engine of trade,
yeah.
a very successful economy. Of course, they are a social democracy. They have unions that represent on all the boards of the major corporations. And my understanding is, for example, in the fight down in Tennessee in Chattanooga that just took place over Volkswagen unionizing, the German company are perfectly comfortable with having unions. They're used to it, and they were all in favor of it. But the political establishment in Tennessee and Senator Corker, who's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and others have basically said, we can't allow these plants to be unionized because it stops us from having the ability to attract factories to our state on the basis that of cheap labor. So how do you explain that paradox that under the Marshall Plan, the U.S. effectively established social democracy in both Germany and Japan, but elements within our country are hostile to that notion?
You know, I'd say that it really reflects the very different political cultures that exist in Germany and the United States. Germany has since World War II, and actually going back earlier, had a very strong tradition of labor and management working together. So you have workers on board, you have alliances across different sectors of industry that you would never see in the United States. And so there is a different notion of what constitutes a social compact. And one of the reasons that AfD has done reasonably well, but not really well, and that Merkel is still in office, is that Germany has this tradition of labor and management working together. It has a tradition of what's called the Mittelstand, which refers to relatively small companies owned by families that have been able to prevent deindustrialization because they have apprentice programs and they represent relatively high-end manufacturing that you can't move offshore because it has sophisticated machine tools, sophisticated technology. You need trained individuals. So the Germans have figured out how to maintain a strong living wage for manufacturing sector workers in ways that the United States has not. And as you put it, Ian, we live in a country where that kind of industrial policy, that kind of state-led growth is anathema to many, but we're paying the price for that because we're dealing with a country in which a very significant swath of the American electorate, even if they have jobs, is not earning a living wage.
And they, in large part, voted for Donald Trump, did they not?
They did, and they did because they're unhappy, and they believe that the political establishment doesn't get it. In Germany, many Germans believe the political establishment gets it, and then you have that core group motivated principally by immigration, not by economic conditions, that is moving toward the far right.
Well, just in closing, returning to the notion that many are seeing Angela Merkel as the leader of the free world, she did have recently had a phone conversation with Vladimir Putin, who is sort of positioning himself as the adult in Northeast Asia in terms of tensions between the United States and North Korea, warning about the possibility of nuclear war between the U.S. and North Korea, which many analysts over here, including perhaps the person who knows North Korea's program better than anybody, Sig Hecker, the former head of Los Alamos, who's concerned that we're going to stumble into a nuclear war. Merkel herself, I believe, I don't know whether she's talked to Trump about this, but she's sort of offering up Germany, is she not, as a possible broker since they have diplomatic relations with North Korea?
Yes, she has suggested that Germany would be ready to step in, playing a role similar to the role that it played in negotiating the Iran agreement, where Germany is not a member of the Security Council. But because they're a major player, the most significant power in Europe, Germany kind of steps in and plays that role. And that's all for the best. One, because she's got her head screwed on. And two, if in fact the United States is going off the reservation and for the next 3.5 years is going to be governed by a president who doesn't really get what it means to fashion a world in which liberal democracies hang together, she's got to play that role. And that means that Germany has to get involved in North Korea, in China, in the Middle East peace process, in places that it really hasn't done for a very long time, because we need a Germany that is ready to shoulder more responsibility.
Well, Charles Kupchan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure as always, Ian.
Thank you, Charles. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as a Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. And his latest book is How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with a veteran sportscaster about how and why Donald Trump has picked a fight with some of the country's biggest stars in football, basketball, and baseball.